Okay, let's go up ahead and open up to Matthew 26. Matthew 26, we're down through verse 16 there. We pointed out that there's a bunch of memorials in this chapter. And we listed them out. I think I did that last time. You had the memorial in those verses 6 to 13 there. The memorial for Lazarus, Martha, and Mary. Mary poured out the family riches over the head of Jesus, worshiping him, acknowledging him as king, and worshiping him at his feet. And her name will be memorialized forevermore. That was the first memorial. Supper, that one that he talks about at the beginning of the chapter here. And that's reminiscent of Malachi 3, where they talk about God's memorial book, his book of remembrance for that believing remnant. The believing remnant of Israel that he's going to create the nation of Israel out of. There's a memorial book for that. There's a memorial here in for Mary and her family here, a memorial written. But there's other memorials in this chapter. Now we're going to read the next memorial. Let's pick it up here at verse 17. The other thing I'll just remind us of, one thing is this memorial concept, but the second thing is this light and darkness concept. Woven throughout this whole chapter, and really to the end of the book, you have light and darkness commingling, intermixing, and you get the light. We had the light with that dinner with Jesus, with Mary, Martha, Lazarus, who was raised from the dead, Simon, who was cleansed of leprosy. We saw that beautiful picture of serving and worshiping and knowledge. And so we had the light, but then we also had the darkness, right? We had Judas, and Judas's darkness even persuaded the disciples to follow him rather than the lead of Mary and Martha. They followed the lead of Judas, grumbling about the pouring out of that ointment and love and adoration and worship of Jesus. So you have the light and dark concept. You have the memorial concept. And so now let's pick it up here. We just had the light with Mary and the family dinner. Then we had Judas. He's now arranged to contracted with the vain religious system to betray Jesus. And now we come back to the light. Verse 17. Now, the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus, saying unto him, "Where wilt thou that we prepare for thee to eat the Passover?" So he's talking, now they're looking ahead. The first day of Unleavened Bread is coming up. The first day is, remember, this is a seven-day festival. We're actually going to read about this in a bit. And then the Passover is the day before that. And so he's looking ahead now, and they need to start preparing. You know, if you're going to do this Passover ritual and you're going to cook it, roast it, we're going to see and all that, you can't just wait to the last minute. You got to prepare a place to have it. You have to prepare the lamb. You have to do all these things. There's this days of preparation in anticipation of the coming Passover that's joined to that Feast of Unleavened Breads, that week of the Feast of Unleavened Breads. So they're getting ready to prepare for that, prepare for the Passover meal. Verse 18, and he said, "Go into the city to such a man and say unto him, the master saith, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at thy house with my disciples." And the Passover, excuse me, and the disciples, did as Jesus had appointed them, and they made ready the Passover. So remember, Jesus is going to eat the Passover early, right? He wants to be slain at the time he wants to be put on that cross at the time they're slaying the Passover lamb. And so he's going to have to eat it a day early. And it's not clear that the disciples fully understand how this is all going to work out here, but now he's sending them. He must have made a pre-arrangement with somebody in Jerusalem. to use their house or their room they have for use, and he's arranged to have it. Now he's telling the disciples, go down and talk to him and tell him now is the time. It says here, say to him, the master saith, now my time is at hand. The time he's been waiting for. Remember, the chapter opened up here, in after 2 days, he's going to have to be crucified. He's going to do that on the day they offer the lambs. And so they need to get prepared for it. They need it ready. And Jesus evidently had somebody in Jerusalem who was going to provide the room. And now he sends his disciples to tell them, now is the time. We're coming. We're going to eat the Passover in your house. This gets... This is kind of interesting to read in the other accounts. We won't go to them, but if you want to look at, I think it's Mark's account, he even gives, it's a little more kind of cloak and dagger. They're supposed to go and secretly talk to this guy, and they'll identify him because he's going to be carrying a pitcher of water. Well, evidently, well, the way I've read it explained is evidently men didn't usually carry pitchers of water. That would have been a woman's job. And so if they saw a man carrying a pitcher of water, they'd know that was the man, and they would know who to talk to and go pick up on this. So it's kind of a fun little account if you add the other gospel accounts to it. We're not going to go over there, but that's something you could do in your own Bible study. So now we have here is a second memorial in this chapter. First memorial was with Mary and her family. Now you have this Passover meal, and you're going to have the light of the Exodus, and it's going to overpower the darkness of Egypt. And that's what I wanted to look at today. So let's go read, what is this Passover meal? Let's go back to Exodus. Exodus 12. And we'll just go through this a little bit. I could spend, you know, a month of Sundays on all the underlying things associated with this Exodus. We're going to see some things. I'm just going to mention them casually because there's just not the time to go into all the detail. But hopefully I give you a bit of a flavor for what's going on in this Exodus. I guess I'll just prepare it by saying it's not just simply a physical Exodus from the land. There's a lot more going on in this account, and I hope to give you just a little bit of a flavor of that as we go through here. So let's go and first of all see what this Passover meal is. This is the whole Exodus accounts. Remember, they send the Pharaoh, and they're, let my people go, and he sends these signs and wonders, the frogs, the rivers turn to blood, the hail, all these things are going on. And of course, the last one is going to be the death of the firstborn. So just, you probably are all very familiar with the general story anyhow. So with that, we're just going to pick it up here at chapter 12. Chapter 12. Let's go back to chapter 11 and let's just introduce it with this. So here we have, this is the final contest. This is on the firstborn. All those other ones have come along and been carried out. And verse 1 of chapter 11. And the Lord said unto Moses, yet will I bring one plague more upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterwards he will let you go hence. When he shall let you go, he shall surely thrust you out, hence altogether. This final sign, this final wonder, this final plague is going to cause Pharaoh not just to casually release them, it's going to cause him to thrust them out. He's going to want to get rid of them as quick as possible. And so now that plays into this Passover concept. They're leaving in haste. They've got to go quick. Verse 2 of chapter 11. Speak now in the ears of the people, and let every man borrow of his neighbor and every woman of her neighbor jewels and of silver and jewels of gold. And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of his people. And Moses said, so they're getting their preparations, their provisions are actually coming from the Egyptians, lower level, obviously, than the Pharaohs. These are the common everyday Egyptians, and they have a favorable attitude toward the Israelites, and they actually provision them. So there's the idea, not only are they going to leave by the skin of their teeth, it's not going to be like that, they're leaving with the riches of Egypt too. And we'll see more of that as we go through here. So now let's get to the actual plague. Verse 4. And Moses said, thus saith the Lord, about midnight will I go out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sitteth upon his throne, even unto the firstborn of the maidservant that is behind the mill, and all the firstborn beasts. And there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as there was none like it, nor shall be like it any more. But against the children of Israel shall not a dog move his tongue, against man or beast, that ye may know how that the Lord doth put a difference between the Egyptians and Israel. Now, notice it says the Lord put a difference between Israel and Egypt. There is no difference between the Israelites and the Egyptians from a sinful human state standpoint. They come out of the same sinful clay. What makes the difference is that God puts a difference between them. God is going to use the nation of Israel. He's going to create the nation of Israel and use it for his own purposes. And he's going to call them out to do that. Not because they're a superior people, not because they're better than anyone else, but because God has decided he's going to use the nation of Israel for his purposes. And he puts a difference. He gives them something that he doesn't give the Egyptians. He gives them this blood sacrifice. He gives them the lamb, the blood of the lamb. And he's going to make a difference between the Egyptians and Israel. Now, this is the beginning of the Exodus. This is right where they're ready to leave. Now, remember what happens 40 years later? Remember, we've talked about this a few times, at the second giving of the law, they're on the other side of the Jordan. They're ready to cross over into the land of Canaan, the promised land. And while Moses is going over the law a second time, what's happening up in the hills of Moab? Very critical step in Israel's history to understand. Up in the hills of Moab, God is explaining to the whole universe that he will never give up on Israel. He explains to the Gentile nations, there's nothing in the physical realm that will make him give up on Israel. Then he explains to Satan and his demonic hosts, nothing in the spiritual realm is going to get me to change my mind about Israel. And then he looks down at Israel from the mountain. He says, not even Israel is going to get me to change my mind about Israel. He pronounces to the whole universe that he is going to fulfill his purpose with Israel. And remember how he describes Israel at the Balaam and Balak account? He says, Israel is separate from the other nations. She will not, she will not be numbered among the other nations. It's his nation, his very own nation. And here it opens with that too, here in Exodus. He puts a difference between the Egyptians and the Israelites. And by the time you get to entering the land, there's a difference between all the other nations of the earth and Israel. Verse 8, and all these thy servants shall come down unto me and bow down themselves unto me, saying, get thee out, and all the people that follow thee, and after that I will go out. And he went out from Pharaoh in great anger. All right, let's go ahead and jump down to chapter 12, because we really want to see this memorial concept picking up from Matthew 26. So now that's the background, chapter 12, verse 1. And the Lord spoke unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Now, here's the first thing to pick up on this Passover. It is so important that he's going to recreate the nation's calendar, recreate the nation's time based on this Passover, this Exodus, this Passover event. He's going to redo their whole calendar. This now is going to be the beginning of their calendar. So it reorients their whole year, their whole time schedule. All right, verse 3. Speak ye unto all the congregation of Israel, saying, in the 10th month of this month, they shall take to them every man a lamb according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for a house. And if the household be too little for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next unto his house take it according to the number of souls. Every man according to his eating shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You shall take it out from the sheep or out from the goats, and you shall keep it until the 14th day. Now just think about this a little. Let's go back in our minds, we won't turn there, but back in our minds to Jesus' entry into Jerusalem for what most people call the triumphal entry. I've suggested it probably a better term would be the untriumphal entry. He goes from Jericho, where he's Lord, Lord, thou son of David, and he's reprimanded by the multitudes. And we find out later what they were rebuking them for is for saying, oh Lord, oh Lord. And so you get the multitudes in Jerusalem and they refuse to say, oh Lord, oh Lord. They do say, worship him by saying, thou son of David, who comes in the name of the Lord. And then you get over to the temple and you have the leaders of Israel, that vain religious, and the leaders in that temple, and they refuse to even acknowledge him as a son of David. As you go from Jericho to entry in the city to the temple, you have a descent. It gets worse and worse and worse. That's why I suggested it wasn't a triumphal entry. It's an untriumphal entry. And he goes in, but the point I want to make here is he enters it on the 14th day before. So he's the one, when it talks about it here, up here, and then he's going to be watched for 4 days until the 10th day. And you shall keep it until the 14th day. So he enters the city of Jerusalem on the 10th, and he's watched. He goes to the city. He goes to the people. He goes to the temple. He goes and withers the fig tree. He does all this stuff in that 4 days. And he's watched. He's the lamb. He's shown to be the spotless lamb. And he's going to now fulfill this. That's the beginning. He goes from the 10th to the 14th as we go through here. Your lamb shall be without blemish, verse 5. And it says, keep it until the 14th day. They watch it to make sure for 4 days to make sure no blemishes come up or nothing they didn't know about before shows up. And they shall take of the blood. They're going to kill it in the evening, verse 6, and then they take the blood and strike it on the two side posts and on the upper door post of the house, of the houses wherein they shall eat. What does that kind of look like? You know, you kind of got a house frame, and the corners kind of looks like that, right? Kind of looks like a cross, the cross beam. And they're going to strike the blood. They're going to put the blood there. And of course, that's a picture of Christ on that cross and his shed blood. And they shall take the blood and strike it on the two posts in the upper door of the houses wherein they shall eat it. And they shall eat the flesh in the night, roast with fire. The night, that's the Passover meal. That's after 6 p.m., which is really the next day. Don't worry, don't run away. I'm not going to go into the whole day thing and Jewish time and all that. But it's that evening, and unleavened bread, and with bitter herbs they shall eat it. And then he goes into a few more of the regulations. Don't eat it raw. Don't let anything remain to the morning, then burn it with fire. Verse 11, and thus shall ye eat with your loins girded, your shoes on your feet, and your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. This is the Lord's Passover. So we see a bunch of things already here. This Passover is very important. It's going to be the division between the Egyptians and the Israelites. It's going to reorient their whole time around God and his feasts. It's going to be the source of their redemption as the angel of death passes over. When they see the blood on those the doorposts, the angel of death is going to pass over. Verse 12, "For I will pass through the land of Egypt this night, and will smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt." Now remember that. It's so often this account is referred, just kind of thought of as a physical deliverance. But see, there's something going on behind the scenes. It's not just Pharaoh and the Egyptians, the human Egyptians. It's also against all the gods of Egypt. It's against Satan. Egypt at this time is Satan's headquarters on earth. Egypt at this time, the Empire of Egypt, is basically ruling the world. So that, and Satan's headquarters are here. And he's working through Egypt. Now, through the Exodus, God's going to destroy the Empire of Egypt. And 40 years later, if we return to our Balaam and Balak account, when they're ready to enter the land, where do they go to look for Satan's man? They go now not to Egypt. They go up to, I guess what we'd call today, Proto-Assyria. They go up north. He's moved his headquarters now up to the what would become Assyria and that Assyrian area. But now, at this time, his headquarters is in Egypt. And you have all these kind of spiritual background things coming in. The waters aren't just waters. The waters are the waters of chaos. They're the waters where Leviathan, the serpent, Satan, dwells. Underneath those waters is the pit, is Sheol, the place of the dead. And its gates open up from underneath the waters, and they're going to try and swat. And the whole purpose of this is this, what's going on behind the scenes here that you can't really see on a human level, is Satan is going to try to swallow up the Israelites. And swallow them and lock them down, bring them down into Sheol, the world of the dead, and end their history before it even begins. And that's what that's some of the background. It's not just the people or the Egyptians and Pharaoh, the human Egyptians and the human Pharaoh. They're the gods behind them, the gods associated with all those other things. And we'll see that as we read some more here. He's going to pass through Egypt, and it's going to be against the gods of Egypt. I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. There we have that I am name again. I am. I'll do it all for you. And the blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt. See, the Israelites and the Egyptians were both under the plague. If you had a rebellious Israelite and he didn't put any blood on his door, maybe he had more friends among the Egyptians than he did the Israelites. He'd been there so long or something, and he didn't do it. You know what would happen to his firstborn? It would be slain. What made the difference between the Israelite and the Egyptian isn't just because they were born Israelite or born Egyptian. It's God put something between them, and they made use of that, put the blood on the lentil, then he would pass over. It was the blood on the lentil, the redemption offered through that. Verse 14, and now we come onto this memorial concept. Verse 14, this brings us back especially to Matthew 26. And this day shall be unto you a memorial, and ye shall keep it a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it a feast by an ordinance forever. 7 days shall ye eat unleavened bread. Even the first day you shall put away leaven out of your house. So there's a day of preparation where you get out the leaven, you prepare the lamb, you do all that other stuff that in order to be ready for the feast. For whosoever eateth leavened bread from the first day until the seventh, that soul shall be cut off from Israel. And in the first day there shall be a holy convocation, and in the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation to you. No manner of work shall be done in them, save that which every man must eat, that only may be done of you. So here we have those Sabbaths. We talked about this when we were saying what day Jesus died on. There's the most people, when they talk talk about the Sabbath, they thought he was referring about the weekly Sabbath. But in fact, the Passover week with the unleavened Feast of Unleavened Breads is a week of Sabbaths. There's more than one. Here we have one at the beginning and one at the end. Verse 17, "And ye shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread, for in this selfsame day have I brought your armies out of the land of Egypt." Now, you got to laugh a little there, right? What armies did Israel have, the Israelites have in Egypt? They don't have any armies. And yet the Lord says here, "On this day, I've brought your armies out." He's looking down the road. He's going to turn them into a great nation. It's his armies that are going to do all the work here. But his armies are their armies. "Therefore shall you observe this day in your generations by an ordinance forever." All right, so we have the second memorial here, this Passover meal, light and darkness. And the darkness of Egypt isn't going to prevail over the light of the Exodus. And we've already mentioned this is Satan's headquarters at this time. He'll later shift it up to Assyria, and then there's going to be another time when it's going to be more Babylon. And he moves it around, working through the empire at the time. And God's going to destroy that. And what I want to bring out now is this Exodus event is a physical deliverance, don't get me wrong, but it's much more than a physical deliverance. It's not just physical deliverance from Pharaoh in Egypt, the physical nation and the physical people who wanted to destroy Israel's sons, attacking the seed of the woman and therefore Christ himself. It's also a deliverance from the gods behind them. It's spiritual deliverance from Sheol, the underworld of death, and the powerful sea serpent, Leviathan, and Satan. And we'll look at a couple of things with that. But first, let's just bring out what's going on here. Go back to the beginning of Exodus and show you what Satan's attack is first going to be here. Go back to Exodus 1, verse 22. And I'm sure you all know the story. Moses is about ready to be born, and Pharaoh comes out with an edict to kill all the sons of the Israelites. And we'll just read it here, verse 22. Exodus 1, verse 22. "And Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive." What's he trying to do there? Now, what he's trying to do is get rid of the Israelites out of his land. But what is Satan trying to do behind that, behind Pharaoh, in getting Pharaoh to do this? What's Satan's plan? He's trying to destroy the line that leads to Christ. Go back to Genesis 3:15 and you'll see what he's trying to do here. He's going to try and destroy the promise God made right after the fall. And he does this several more times in history. There actually comes a point in Israel's history when there's only one male child, one son left in the line of Jesus. And if he were killed, it would end the line of Jesus. But he's preserved, of course, and the line of Jesus continued. The point is, Satan's constantly attacking the line of Jesus, and what he's trying to do is get rid of this promise in Genesis 3:15. This is right after the fall. He's cursed the serpent, verse 15, "And I will put enmity between thee," the serpent, Satan, "and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed." So there's going to be a line that comes from Satan and a line that comes from the woman. And of course, we know the line that comes from the woman is going to culminate in Christ. And this is what he's going to do. "It, the seed of the woman, shall bruise thy head," the serpent's head. He's going to crush. I got them backwards here. "It shall bruise thy head." That's the serpent seed is going to bruise the head. It will bruise the head. That's Christ. He's going to bruise. He's going to crush the head of the serpent. He's going to destroy the serpent. But then it says, "Thou shalt bruise his heel." The serpent is only going to be able to bruise his heel. Of course, that happens on the cross. Now, the cross looks like he bruised his head, right? But then there's the resurrection. And then it becomes evident Satan just bruised his heel because he was raised from the dead. But on that same cross, Jesus bruises, he crushes Satan, destroys Satan. And that's the promise going all the way back here to chapter 3, verse 15. And what Satan's going to try and do is try and interrupt the seed of the woman so that it interrupts the arrival of Christ, of the one who's going to destroy, bruise his head, bruise the serpent's head. And he's going to destroy him. The serpent will be able to bruise his heel on that cross. But God will raise him from the dead, and Christ will bruise Satan's head, crush it, destroy, completely destroy. And that's what Satan is trying to break, put a break in that seed of the woman that leads to Christ over and over and over and over again, so that he gets rid of Christ, gets rid of the Lord Jesus Christ. And this prophecy doesn't come true. Of course, we know it has now come true. But so when he has Pharaoh, see, it's not just Pharaoh out of fear that the Israelites are more numerous than the Egyptians on that level. That's true. That's a fear for the Pharaoh. But what's behind that is Satan trying to destroy the line that leads to Christ. And he's going to, the whole spiritual battle going on behind the scenes is the point I'm trying to make here in this Exodus. It's not just a physical deliverance from Pharaoh and the people or the armies of Egypt. It's a deliverance from what's behind them, the satanic world, the demonic world that's behind them, that's working through Pharaoh and Egypt. The underworld. It's a deliverance from Sheol, from the underworld, the darkness of Egypt, the powerful sea serpent, Leviathan, Satan. There's all that's going on in the background. If you keep that in mind, we're going to read a couple more passages, and I think it'll just kind of all fall in place. But before we do that, let's look at some other things about Egypt as the as Satan's headquarters now on the earth. And let's do that by going to Genesis 37. And I just want to show you that every time going to Egypt is talked about at this time, it's always a descent. They go down to Egypt. It's down. And there's something else that you go down. And we'll read about that. Go to Genesis 37 on the way back to Exodus. Genesis 37, this is the Joseph account. Remember, Jacob sends out Joseph to check on his brothers watching the sheep. They grow jealous, the whole dream thing and all that kind of stuff. And they're going to throw Joseph in the pit. And let's pick it up with there. And let's see how they describe this. Go to Genesis 37, verse 25. I guess we got to begin at verse 24. And they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty, and there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread. Well, that's kind of callous, isn't it? They just throw their brother in a pit they know doesn't have any water. So if they leave him there for any length of time, he's going to die. He's not going to be able to live. And they go and sit down and eat a snack. They go down and sit and eat lunch. And they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh going, and listen to this, going to carry it down to Egypt. Egypt is always a descent. And it's there's something else that's going to come up in this this account that's a descent as well. Come, let us, verse 27, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh, and his brethren were content. And it goes through here, the Midianites come along, take him out of the pit, they sell him, and they take him to Egypt. And he returned unto his brother in verse 3, and he says, the child is not. Verse 31, and they took Joseph's coat and killed a kid of goats and dipped the coat in blood, and they sent the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, this have we found. Know now whether it be thy son's coat or no. And he knew it and said, it is my son's coat. This is Jacob now, and the father of Joseph. An evil beast has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent to piece in pieces. And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Now verse 35. And all his sons and all daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, for I will go down to the grave. If you have a reference Bible, you see that's the Hebrew word Sheol. I go down to the grave. I go down to Sheol. The same direction you go to Egypt, the same descent you make to Egypt is the same descent you make to Sheol. And he go down into the grave unto my son, mourning him. That's Egypt is always discerned that way. It's always a descent. Well, of course, the flip side of that then is that what God's going to do is raise Israel up, ascend Israel out of Egypt. They've descended down into Egypt. In the spiritual, in the physical realm, it's Egypt. In the spiritual realm, it's a representation of Sheol and the sphere of Satan and his demonic hosts. He's going to have to ascend them then to deliver them out of Egypt, Sheol and Satan. Flip over a few pages now to chapter 46. Chapter 46, verse 1. Now we're further in the account. The whole Joseph's ruling in Egypt now. He interacts with the brothers. They go. They get Jacob. Jacob's going to come back now to Joseph. And we'll pick it up there in chapter 46. Jacob is going to journey to Egypt now. And Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices unto the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke unto Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here am I. And he said, I am God. There you have that Jehovah name. I am blank space. Here it's I am God, but Jehovah on its own. I am blank space. I am your deliverer. I am your avenger. I am your conquering hero. I am your provider. I am your righteousness. I am whatever you need me to be. I will be it for you. I will do everything for you. If Israel's going to be the nation God created her to be, he would have to do everything for her. Of course, that's where they went wrong at Sinai, right? They flunked the test at Sinai, and they said, we'll do everything ourselves. And they spent 1,500 years under the law, under the curses of the law. Out in the end of that tribulation, when Christ returns, they're going to pass the exam. They're going to give the right answer. And they're going to say, Lord, treat us graciously. And they're just going to hold up the rod of God of faith and fall on the grace resident in his Jehovah name. He's going to usher them in that kingdom, and he's going to do everything for them. I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go, and here we have it again, go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. Does that sound familiar? Remember in our parables, we talked about this. Remember, this whole Exodus account is like a foretaste of what's going to happen out in that tribulation. Remember the parable? He's going to hide his treasure in the world. That's what he's doing with the Israelites here. He hides his treasure in Egypt. And he's going to make of them, right under the noses of the Egyptians, he's going to make of them a great people. Right under the nose of Satan, he's going to make them a great people. What does Pharaoh say? He said, where'd these Israelites come from? There's a new Pharaoh comes, and where'd these Israelites come from? They're more numerous than us. They're going to take us over. And that's just a foretaste of what's happening out in that tribulation period. He's going to hide his people, that believing remnant in the world, right under the noses of the rebellious Gentiles, right under the noses of Satan and his cohorts, and he's going to make of them a great nation. And at his return, he's going to deliver them out of the world, out of that world and into the kingdom. And when he does that, just as here the Egyptian empire fell, out there the work Satan's world system is going to fall. And he's going to usher his people into that kingdom. So you get all this as a foretaste of what's coming at the future, the greater exodus out in that tribulation period. And he says, verse 4, I will go down with thee into Egypt. Notice the descent going down. But now look what he says, and I will also surely bring thee up again. There you have the ascent. There you have him bringing him up again. Go over to Exodus 13. Exodus 13, and we'll see this again. Exodus 13, 19. Exodus 13, 19. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had straitly sworn the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry my bones away hence from you. Now, if you remember, Joseph, to get to Egypt, went down. Now, to carry him out and back home, they're going to have to go up as the ascension. And they're going to be delivered out of Egypt. Not just the Pharaoh, the physical Pharaoh and the his army, but from the spiritual realm behind them. He's going to be delivered from the waters of death. We're going to see that in a minute. Redemption from Sheol, this descent into Sheol, into the light of God and his land of Canaan. They're going to move now to the light. Remember Matthew 26, that light and darkness theme? They're intermingling, and that's what we're going to see here. Go over to now Exodus. While you're in Exodus 13, let's look at a couple other verses. Exodus 13, verse 3. And Moses said unto the people, remember this day in which you come out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand of the Lord brought you out from this place. There shall be no leavened bread. This day came ye out in the month of Abib, and it shall be when the Lord shall bring thee into the land of the Canaanites, into his promised land. The Hittites, Amorites, Hivites, Jebusites, which he swore unto the fathers to give thee, a land flowing with milk and honey, that thou shalt keep this service in this month. It's all part of this Passover memorial. They've descended into Egypt, and it represents the descent into Sheol. He's going to ascend them out, and he's going to take them to his own land, and he's going to get them there with the light. Let's just look at that one last thing. Look at verse 21, and you see the light component now. It's still in Exodus 13, verse 21. And the Lord went before them day by day in a pillar of a cloud to lead them the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light to go by day and night. He took not away the pillar of the cloud by day, nor the pillar of the fire by night from before the people. He leads them with his light. He's going to lead them. He bring the light, is going to have power, is going to overcome the darkness, just as we've seen in our Matthew account. The angel of the Lord in a pillar of cloud separating the Israelites from the Egyptians, to Israel, a shining light, and the crossing of the Red Sea dry shod, but to Egypt darkness and being swallowed by the waters of chaos. Flip over another page to verse chapter 14, verse 19. Chapter 14, verse 19. And let's see how this starts to all come together. And now it's going to get focused more and more on the spiritual background, what's going on in the background of all this. Verse 19. Verse 19. And the angel of God, which went before the camp of Israel, removed and went behind them. Now remember, they're down, they're on their journey, and they're heading towards the Exodus, exiting Egypt, and they look ahead, and what do they see? They see the Red Sea. So then they go, well, we can't go that way. So they turn around and look behind them, and what do they see? they see the Egyptian armies with their horses galloping and their chariots clanging, and they're coming right down for them. That's exactly the position Satan wanted them to be in. He wanted to push them into the sea, where they would drown. Yes, they drown physically, but what's going on in that sea is that sea, is with the, they say, chaos, waters of chaos underneath that sea is the Sheol, the world of the dead, and it's going to open its gates and it's going to come up, and Satan wants to swallow the Israelites, force them into the sea and swallow them up and close the gates of Sheol over them. But let's see what happens. And the angel, verse 19. So that's what we have coming on here. So the first thing God does is says, the angel of the Lord, which went before the camp of Israel, removed and went behind them. And the pillar of the cloud went from before their face and stood behind them. So God went behind them, between the Israelites and the Egyptian army. And it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. And it was a cloud and darkness to them. To them, it was darkness. He didn't shed any, there wasn't any light shed on them. But it gave light by night to these, the Israelites, so that the one came not near to the other all night. And Moses stretched out his hand. Now they're trying to push the Israelites into the Red Sea. Satan's ready. He's got his waters of chaos. He's opening up the pits of Sheol. They get in there. They're going to fall down into the pit of Sheol. It's going to close its gates over them. All done, Israel. That's the plan. And Moses, but look what Moses does, verse 21. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. So God now intervenes. Moses holds out his hand, and God separates the waters and holds them up. He tames the waters of chaos. He tames the waters where Leviathan and the sea serpent is working. He tames them and puts them up and stops them. And he makes the land dry. Just remember that dry land. If you think it's just the wind blowing over the bottom here, and he's made it dry so they can go and they don't, their shoes don't get wet, we're going to see it's not quite like that. But they go through then, and then what happens? By a strong east wind all that night, made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon the dry ground, and the waters were a wall unto them on each side. The waters of chaos were Satan and the sea serpent and his area, his element, I guess it might be the best word to say. And verse 23, and the Egyptians pursued and went in after them in the midst of the sea, even all of Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen. And it came to pass that in the morning watch, the Lord looked unto the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of the fire of the cloud and troubled the host of the Egyptians. Now they followed him in to these tamed waters of the Red Sea. They followed him in, the Egyptian hosts. And he took off their chariot wheels and drove them heavily, so that the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them. The Egyptian army here has a more clear understanding of what God does for Israel than Israel does, once we get later in the account, against the Egyptians. Verse 26, and the Lord said unto Moses, stretch out thine hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, upon their horses. And Moses stretched forth his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its strength when the morning appeared, and the Egyptians fled against it, and the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. So you get the idea here. He pushes up the water. They go through. The Israelites go through. The Egyptian army follows them. He releases the waters, and it comes back over. And the idea here is that Satan has been caught in his own trap. He intended to catch the Israelites in the waters of chaos and open up the pit of Sheol to swallow them up. But God intervened. And we see a different way of looking at this account now in the next passage. So go down to verse 12. Go down to chapter 15. Go down to chapter 15. And here we pick it up, and we'll have to close with this. But this is really what we're getting at here. It's not just a physical deliverance. The first account really emphasized, kind of, you could kind of think of it as a physical deliverance. The second account, the song of Moses and the people singing about it, shows there's other things going on here behind the scenes. Verse 1, chapter 15, verse 1. Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord, and spoke, saying, I will sing unto the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song. Moses gets it, and the people at this point are singing along with, so they get it to some degree here as well. And he became my salvation. He is my God, and I will prepare him a habitation. My father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord, that Jehovah name again, he'll be their conquering hero. He'll do it for them. If they tried to beat the Egyptians on their own, they would have been completely annihilated. The Lord had to do it for them. Verse 4, Pharaoh's chariots and his host has he cast into the sea. His chosen captains are drowned in the Red Sea. The depths are covered over them. And get the idea here. Now he's covered up. He's brought the chaos of the sea back down upon them. He stopped the chaos of the sea so the Israelites could go through. And then he brings it back down on the Egyptian army, and it swallows them up. What was intended for their Israelites ends up swallowing up the Egyptians. Verse 5, the depths have covered them. They sank to the bottom as a stone. Thy right hand, O Lord, has become glorious in power. Thy right hand, O Lord, hath dashed in pieces the enemies. And in the greatness of thine excellency, thou hast overthrown them that rose up against thee. Thou sentest forth thy wrath, which consumed them as stubble. And the blast of thy nostrils, the waters were gathered together. The flood stood upright as a heap. And here's an important verse and the phrase, and the depths were congealed in the heart of the sea. They were congealed in the heart of the sea. It's not just that God provided a way, put some ground there and dried it off with the wind so they could walk through. The idea there is he controlled the waters of chaos, Satan's element. He pushed them back. And when if you could have seen it at that point, the pit of Sheol was open and the gates are closing up to get them. And he congeals it. He puts back the waters of chaos, and he congeals. He closes the pit of Sheol, and they go over that. And when they're over it and the Egyptians come in, he uncongeals the pit, brings down the waters of chaos, and Satan and his cohorts are caught in their own trap. It swallows up the Egyptians instead of swallowing up the Israelites. Verse 9, the enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My lust shall be satisfied upon them. I'll draw my sword, my hand shall destroy them. Thou didst blow with thy wind, the sea covered them. They sank as lead in the mighty waters. They sank down, 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 down into the pit of Sheol. Verse 11. And now we get to the key thing here. This is the way the account starts, and this is the way it's going to end. Who is like unto thee, O Lord, among the gods? See, the issue isn't just the physical Pharaoh and the physical Egyptian armies. The main thrust here is the spiritual element behind Pharaoh and his armies. Those Satan and his demons that are the gods of Pharaoh and the Egyptians. It's all about that. That even those signs and wonders, they were to demonstrate to the world and to the Egyptians and to Pharaoh that God is the one true God and more powerful than any of their little g gods. And he says here, verse 11, who is like unto thee, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like thee, glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders? Thou stretchest out thy hand, the earth swallowed them. Thou in thy mercy hast led forth thy people, which thou hast redeemed. Thou hast girded them in the strength of thy holy habitation. That's the memorial of the Passover. That's what they're supposed to be remembering at that Passover. They're supposed to be reliving that Passover every week, not just a physical overpowering of some Gentile nation, but the spiritual overpowering of the satanic realm that preserved the nation of Israel, carried them through the waters of chaos, where the Leviathan and the sea monster and Satan, their element. The same, remember we saw something like this, I think it was in Matthew 8, where Jesus and his disciples crossed the sea, and they got halfway over the sea, and the seas tried to swallow them up. Of course, that was the Sea of Galilee, not the Red Sea. Sea of Galilee, and Jesus calmed the waters. That's that same idea. It's not just there was a physical storm. It's that Satan was opening the pit of Sheol and was going to swallow them up before they could get to the other side. I remember the rest of the story. They're going to the other side to destroy the angelic hosts. Excuse me, the demonic hosts, satanic hosts. Same thing going on here. It's not just a physical deliverance, it's a spiritual deliverance. Not just from Pharaoh and his army, but from Sheol, from death, from darkness, from Satan, from all those things. And we'll just close in the Lord created the nation of Israel to be his own nation, a light unto all the nations who lived in darkness. That's their goal. That's why he's pulled them out. We see them already doing this just before they enter that law contract at Sinai in rebellion against God and his grace. Just before that, what do you see up in the hill, the mountain there? You see the people of Israel and Moses' father-in-law, who is a Midianite. You know what a Midianite is? He's a Gentile. And he's a Gentile, and he's there fellowshipping together with the Israelites, worshiping the one true God. Before they ever get to that law, before they get to Sinai, God has already turned them and made them do what they're supposed to be doing, because he did it for them. And that's what they missed. That's what they gave up on. But they'll get it right, as I said earlier, at his second coming. The Exodus signs and wonders revealed to Israel the grace resident in that Jehovah name. What our English Bibles have capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. It's only through the grace resident in his Jehovah name and faith is the only way they're going to be the people God intended them to be. He has to do it for them. And that's what this Passover shows. If they had to do it themselves, they would have been destroyed. They would have been destroyed in Egypt. They would have been destroyed by the Egyptian armies. They would have been destroyed by the waters. They would have been destroyed by hunger. They would have been destroyed by thirst. They would have been destroyed by more enemies. But God did everything for them. And they come out and they are delivered for this Exodus. Of course, the Exodus is revealed to other nations, the power and glory in God's Jehovah name. I got a bunch of verses here. This might be something to do. We won't turn to all of them now. I'll just point out that's what he said to Pharaoh. That's in Exodus 5, 8, and 15. That they might know who the Lord God is. Pharaoh says, who is the Lord? I don't care about the Lord, and I'm not going to do what he says. And you go through, and God keeps trying to show them who the Lord is, who the Lord is, who the Lord is. And he puts on display his power and glory through this this Exodus event. And remember from our study in Romans 9, he postpones the deliverance of Israel while he does another thing, makes his name known in the world. And then when you get to a generation later, remember this woman called Rahab in Jericho, when they're ready to enter the land, they send the spies in and she helps them escape. And remember her? I guess we could look at that one last thing. It's such a wonderful passage, and we'll close with that. Go to Joshua. Go to Joshua, and we'll close with Rahab here and what the Exodus meant for her. Joshua 2, verse 9. Joshua 2, verse 9. This is Rahab. She let the Israelite spies go. And she said unto the men, she's talking to them now, Joshua 2, verse 9, and said unto the men, I know, she knows, that the Lord hath given you the land, and that your terror is fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land faint because of you. Why? Verse 10, for we have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Red Sea. And hopefully you realize now it's not just a physical miracle. It was his overpowering the demonic spiritual realm. That's what she sees in this. And when you came out of Egypt, and then he's been destroying their enemies all the way to the promised land along the way. That's what that Passover is. That's what they're celebrating. They're going to celebrate here. And that's where we are with this memorial in Matthew 26. But then we're going to go on to another memorial. And that's going to be the last, what's called there, the Last Supper, I guess we call it. And that's going to be another memorial. Luke 22 says, do this in remembrance of me.